session number 9706, reel 4.
Mr. Lawrence, reel 4.
You went outside into this sort of wooden structure and tried to do your motion. Well, of course, if you were weak, already very, very weak from the dysentery, etc., and lack of food, then, of course, what really happened was you fell through the hole into the sea, and many a chap lost came to an end that way.
Can you recollect your movements in Japan? Which particular camps you went to and approximately when?
Now, this becomes a little blurred because I went to Moji and we did stevedoring. We were ship coaling and various loading ships with cement and pig iron and that sort of thing. And I was at Moji for some considerable time, and then I was moved. I don't know the exact date. And I cannot, I've tried to look back on my diaries to see whether I've got any, and I haven't. I gradually was moving south in Kyushu, on the island of Kyushu. This is towards Nagasaki. I went from there to a camp which was doing a copper refinery. It was a copper refinery. And that was a horrifying sort of conditions to work under. I was there for some while, and then I was moved to a coal mining camp. And then I remember the January of 1945, because I was moved again. And that was my last move, because I was taken to a camp, to a place where there were only a few of us fellows, very small number. And when we arrived there, we turned to the other fellows, who were a mixture of American, Dutch, Australian, and said, "Where are we?" And one rather amusing wag, you always found one, real Aussie, real Australian accent, said, "Fancy not knowing where you are. Haven't you met Madame Butterfly yet?" And I said, "Nagasaki." And he said, "Yes, you're in Nagasaki. You're at Fukuoka 14. Hoorah." I can't imitate his Australian language. And that's, but I remember that because it was winter, and anybody that says that, thinks that there's a mild climate in Japan, well, wants another think, because it seems to be extremes. In the summer, it used to be so sweltering hot, that in the winter, it was short. I would say from about the middle of December to about the middle of February, the winter was very, very harsh. After that, it got better and better. It got spring-like, and then... But it's a short but extremely harsh winter.
So was Fukuoka 14 the camp you were in when the bomb dropped?
Yes.
Did you say it was a small camp?
Yes, it wasn't a very, very large camp. There were one or two other camps around us that I didn't know about at the time, till much later, which were also small camps.
What work were you doing at Fukuoka 14?
Well, and eventually I ended up working for the Mitsubishi Engineering, the engineering yards. And that, of course, went up in smoke. Well, it didn't go up in smoke, but that, of course, suffered complete damage from the bomb.
Whereabouts was the camp in Nagasaki?
Whereabouts was it?
Approximately.
It was just outside Nagasaki, in actuality, but close enough for us to actually work at the Mitsubishi yards. at the Mitsubishi steel plant. It was a place called Seiwa Mashi.
How do
it's
you spell
spelt
it?
Saiwaimachi.
So about how far from the centre of Nagasaki would
well
you be?
Well, when the actual bomb dropped, I was within a mile and a half of the epicentre.
Can you tell me in as much detail as you can recollect about your memories of how the bomb dropped?
I remember that I was working outside because we'd had a lot of bombing from the Americans. The Americans had come over doing quite a bit of bombing. And some of them used to come down very low and drop bombs, and that seemed always worse because it was as though I don't suppose those fellows knew that they were prisoners of war, they themselves. The authorities did, I know that, but I don't suppose those fellows, all they were thinking of was bombing Japanese. So we'd had quite a bit of bombing. A lot of damage had been done all around us. And, of course, the Japanese naturally put a number of us to the job of clearing a lot of the mess up. So we were, quite a few of us, shifting rubble and all sorts of things into heaps. And on the particular morning of the... for quite some weeks before, apart from this bombing, we used to have regularly reconnoitering planes used to come over very high. I always recognise them as what we called recce planes, because they flew very high, used to fly in a certain circle, and I knew, from my knowledge of the RAF, of course, that they were taking photographs. There was no opposition went up against them. But apart from that, Americans used to come over and do a lot of bombing. And we did lose a few fellows that way. They were blown to bits, amongst a number of Japanese. And we were clearing up this on this particular morning. My memory serves me right. Well, it was. There's no doubt about it. It was about 11 o'clock in the morning. It was a hot summer's day. Pretty cloudless. I understand since the instructions to the pilots of dropping that bomb were to drop them at a place called Kokura, which is just by Meiji. I was meant to receive that bomb. Talk about fate. But if that was clouded over and they couldn't see where they were dropping it, they were to go on to Nagasaki and drop it there. Well, there was a certain amount of cloud, but there was plenty of brilliant sunshine on that morning. And the plane came over, and I looked up, and I could see the glistening in the undercarriage in the fuselage, and there were certain reflections. Now, to my knowledge, that said to me, from my knowledge of aircraft, oh, they've opened the bomb door, and I've caught the reflection in the sun. I was by a rather large mound of rubble, and I stood looking at that plane, and quite suddenly there was the most vivid, most awful flash, a terrible booming noise, and a feeling of hot wind and air. I can remember the flash being sufficiently vivid for me, for some reason or other, to cover my left eye. But I shut tight my right eye. Talking as an optician, it's a godsend that it was a brilliant, sunny light, because it meant that my pupils of my eyes were at their tiniest. Had that been dropped at night with my pupils wide open, I would have probably been blinded completely. As it is, all I ended up from that point of view was having a flash cataract on my right eye, but didn't penetrate my left eye. Now, the next thing I realized was a sort of a sucking noise, and seeing black smoke, what I thought was black smoke, rising in the air in the usual spiral, and then the mushroom cloud, which seemed to get bigger and bigger and seemed to be blotting out the sun. And yet I was still standing there and sort of looking at all this, not knowing what it was at all or anything at all about it. After this had happened, I remember the soldier who was near me, a Japanese soldier, saying to me in Japanese, also rather appalled, Nandaska, which in Japanese means, what's that? And I replied, I don't know, Mr. Soldier. To my amazement, he left his rifle and turned and ran back towards the camp. Well, my next thought was to look around me at what fellows I knew were around. But what few fellows there were around were dead. But I didn't have a scratch on me. Later on, much later on, I learned that the way that bomb was dropped and coming up the Urakami River, was fortunate as far as I was concerned, because the very fact that there was this huge sort of stack of mound on one particular side and I was the other side, it didn't harm me. Now, it's almost unbelievable that afterwards, when I moved back to camp in a daze, our camp had gone, the whole perimeter fence was down. It had gone. Everything around me was as though it was in a state of quietude rather than anything else. I thought, by the look and appearance of the mushroom cloud, that we'd hit an oil dump, because I'd seen oil dumps hit before, and they always sent up this sort of deep bellowing cloud, which seemed to bellow into a mushroom. And I thought, oh, they've hit the oil dump at the shipyards. I didn't know anything about an atomic bomb, and I certainly had never heard of Hiroshima. So I got back to camp, and I found chaos and everything else. But as I was going, there were, well, what I can call the most appalling sights around me. There were trees which on one side were dead white. Dead white. Foliage gone. The trunks and the branches were dead white. And the other side was intact, all with its foliage. There were hills, small hills, and it was as though somebody had whitewashed one side in a straight line and left the grass to grow on the other side. I remember crossing a little tiny bridge, and there were shadows in the concrete of people, shadows, actually emblazoned in the concrete. No people, but just the shadows. It was obvious to me that somebody had been sitting there or standing there. And there, in the concrete, was the shadow of a sitting person and the shadow of a standing person.
Were there any human remains?
There were human remains of people around. And what? Only when I looked back on it, even a few days later, that what I was surrounded by, it was too horrific and too nauseating and too terrible to even, well, I was in such a daze myself, what we all were. The Japanese were dazed. I saw people hurrying furtively around as if they were like little running rats and not making a sound. We were all in a complete and utter daze. All those that lived were in a daze.
What was so nauseating?
The smell and the sight of bodies which were, well, I don't know if ever you've been to a slaughterhouse and seen raw meat, dripping blood, or raw meat, or slices of in that kind. Or that's what those bodies looked like. Some people, to the my astonishment, were absolutely ripped. Their flesh was ripped raw from head to toe on one side, yet they seemed intact on the other side. So it depended upon which way they happened to be facing at the particular time.
Were they alive?
On one occasion, I saw a little girl. One side of her was burned completely and the other side was untouched. And all she did was sit there whimpering. Just whimpering, not crying in agony, not in anything, just sitting there whimpering. It was an appalling state of affairs, inasmuch as when I've been and had witnessed, even in London before I went abroad, I was there in London when we had bombing raids, and you always heard the terrible noise and the cries for help, or the screaming, or people crying in pain. There was sound, there was noise. The incredible thing that struck me about this was the silence. The silence. As if everybody had been sort of hypnotized or put into a sleep. We were sleepwalking. And the next thing, of course, was Japanese realized, of course, that it was very hot. You had all this flesh and bodies around. Before we knew where we were, we'd be in plague. So, of course, it was really a case, muck in and get as many bodies heaped up as you can and set fire to the lot. I'm sad to say, amongst it were a number of our fellows. You didn't wait to see whether they were really, you knew that they couldn't be saved. In any case, the Japanese themselves were too busy trying to see to their own to see to us. So you set fire to it because you knew very well what was going to happen. There was going to be plague. You couldn't have all that mess around, but there were thousands. So really and truly, with such sights which were unimaginable, and sights I'd never seen before. I'd seen plenty of bombing. Oh yes, London and later on in various places. As I say, I spoke of my Singapore time. I'd seen it. But I'd never ever seen anything like this, and I couldn't understand. And we were asked by certain Japanese to help to see if there were any more people alive that could be helped. And I came across this little girl that I mentioned. And I picked her up. And I carried her to the Japanese soldier, who by now did not carry their rifles at all. And he put her on a truck. She was just whimpering. And it was such a sight. And I remember saying to the Japanese, "What have we done to you?" And the tears, it's a very rare thing to see a Japanese cry, I must say. Very rare thing. The tears rolled down his eyes, and he said, "What have we done to each other?" And from that moment, I felt at one with them. All the misery, starvation, all the 3.5 years of what I've been through seemed to vanish, and I felt that they were the same as me and I was the same as them, and we just were trying to help one another. And that's how it was. It was general. What prisoners of war were left were doing just that.
Was there anything you could do for the girl?
She was taken away on that truck. I don't know whether she lived or not.
Did the Japanese try to retaliate against you because of it?
No. No, they were deeply grateful for the fact that we prisoners that were left were trying to help them. It was as though everything that had gone on in the 3.5 years was neutralized. They in no way showed any form of retaliation towards us. They showed only gratitude that we were trying to help. But it was terribly, the smell, I can't describe the smell was the most nauseating smell.
You mean of rotting flesh?
Of rotting flesh, yes, and of the burned flesh. Do you know that, have you ever been to the dentist, and he's used a very, very high-powered drill, very fast drill, and you get the sort of faint smell of, the faint smell of burning bone. Imagine that magnified a few million times. Burning flesh. It's the most horrible, nauseating smell. It's appalling. We were very, very thankful that soon after the dropping of the bomb, we had the most torrential rain and we had a typhoon. And believe you me, I think that helped save us a great deal. Because, first of all, it seemed to wash a lot of things. And the other thing was that terrific wind seemed to blow away a lot of stuff. But we still didn't know what had happened to us. On August the 15th, it was the 15th to us, there, it was 14th here, the Japanese allowed us to hear a radio and everything now. And I heard a radio, and I heard the voice of the Emperor of Japan. It was a high-pitched voice. And I listened to it. And he was saying that they had surrendered. They'd given up. And they had surrendered unconditionally to the Allies to save the great and holy land of Japan. And they played the Japanese national anthem, the Koga, as it is called. And one or two of the fellows said to me, Sid, did you understand? Who was it? And I said, it was the Emperor of Japan. And he says, the war's over. It's all over. They've surrendered. And the fellows looked at one another, and one of them said, poor old Sid, I think he's gone round the bend. As a matter of fact, in a way, I felt that I had. But it was the truth. That's what it was. We played around with this radio set, and then the next thing we heard, we got music, the Blue Danube. And when the music stopped, an American voice said, this is the voice of Chungking, China. The tonic bomb dropped on Nagasaki has ended the war. The Japanese have surrendered. Now, we all thought, he said, the tonic bomb, T-O-N-I-C. What, we asked one another, was a tonic bomb? We didn't know. It was not until the Americans actually arrived in to take us out that we learned what he had said was the atomic bomb.
Some people I've spoken to have said that conventional bombing, the very big raids like the Tokyo fire raid, were just as bad, if not worse, than the atomic bombing. Does that accord with your own experience?
I can't say. I think people's reactions to different things, whatever they are, here I always go into quoting the Gospels. Not because I'm a religious fanatic, but I've had many a discussion in my lifetime. People have said, do you think that the Gospels are true stories of the life of Jesus? And I've said, yes, I do. Why are you so sure? And I say, Each one of those Gospels tells a slightly different story. If they were all identical, I would say no human being sees a thing identical in the same way or reacts identically. But the mere fact that there's a variation here of what one of the disciples saw or did shows to me a certain truth. You can have a person standing on a street corner. There's a half a dozen of you. And there's a car accident. You're all there standing there watching. A policeman comes along and says, did anybody witness this? And you say, yes. And you will have half a dozen different stories that you all saw exactly the same thing. Over the many years in discussion over this particular point, I've said to myself, a lot depends upon the person as to what their reaction is to certain things. I was horrified at the London bombing. I was horrified at bombing in various places wherever I was. But it was destruction. To me, my reaction is, it was destruction. Places fell to the ground. There was rubble. People were killed. Some were dug out of holes. But this was something so horribly intangible. In any of them, did you ever see a tree in which half of it was killed dead and the other half alive? Did you ever see people's bodies emblazoned in concrete? Did you ever see people wandering around just whimpering when half their body was the hanging flesh? Did you ever see people wandering around completely blinded, yet not another mark on them? Did you ever see people after a bombing raid walking around as if they'd been hypnotized by something? Well, I never did. To me, this was so unusual, so unique in its particular after effects that it was just mind-boggling. That's all I can say.
Did the bomb on Nagasaki bring administration to a complete halt?
At first it did. It was utter chaos, but I must hand it to the Japanese. The bomb dropped to us on the 10th. On the 13th, they had a train running. Coming from I don't know where, they had actually had a train running into Nagasaki. I don't know where it came from. So within 3 days, they were absolutely getting themselves organized. They were doing all sorts of, the doctors, everything. I don't know where they were taking these people. They weren't really half the things. We didn't know which of the other half were doing. We had to manage with regard to food. When people talk about fallout and they talk about radiation, I'd like to remind them that we were eating food, drinking water from the Yukurame Valley Reservoir. We didn't know that there was such a thing as contamination. Well, I know that a lot of the fellows died afterwards. Some from radiation sickness, others from other causes. I know that. But we didn't know at the time. We were just carrying on and doing our best for the Japanese as much as for ourselves. We were like one afflicted people then. Quite a few of the fellows couldn't stomach it, and we were left to ourselves. There was no sort of any more, you were prisoners. Some of the fellows couldn't stomach it and made off. Two or three of the fellows came to me and said to me, oh, we can't stomach this anymore, Sid. We have heard a rumour that